Ladies and gentlemen, this is Tim Binall of binallofamerica.com with another edition of Binall of America Audio Season 1. It is December 3rd, 2005. We are back after our two-week hiatus. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving, didn't spend too much money on Black Friday, and have resumed your normal weekly schedule, as have we. Let's get down to business. This week, it is Adam Go Rightly. Some of you may not have heard of Adam Go Rightly, so let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a self-described crackpot historian, the author of The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos, and The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the story of Kerry Thornley and how he met Oswald and inspired the counterculture. He's also the author of the newly released The Beast of Adam Go Rightly, Collected Rantings, 1992 to 2004. He's been a guest on radio talk shows across the U.S. and Canada, and his articles have appeared in numerous publications such as The Excluded Middle, UFO Magazine, Paranoia, and Steam Shovel Press. His website is www.adamgorightly.com. This interview was recorded on December 1st, 2005, a scant 48 hours ago, so it's ultra fresh. Let's rock and roll. Adam Go Rightly on Binall of America Audio, Season 1.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a little departure from our usual sort of UFO stylings this week with a very special guest, Adam Go Rightly. He's the author of a few books here, The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos, and The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the story of Kerry Thornley and how he met Oswald and inspired the counterculture. And Adam's a pretty well-known character in the conspiracy world. He's been a guest on radio talk shows across the U.S., Canada, and Ireland. His articles have appeared in numerous publications such as The Excluded Middle, UFO Magazine, Paranoia, and Steam Shovel Press. And you can contact Adam at your own risk at www.adamgorightly.com. And that's adamgorightly.com. Welcome to the show. Adam, thank you for checking out Binall of America Audio and appearing on the show.
Yeah, very good. Thanks for having me today. And yeah, we can always talk UFOs, too.
Oh, I'm sure we're going to get into that. I'm sure we are. Well, first of all, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background? Where, you know, just give me a little bio sketch here for the people who are unfamiliar with Adam Go Rightly.
My writing career really took off in the early 90s when the whole zine movement was going on, the underground press, and I got pretty heavily involved with that back in that period with magazines like Steam Shovel Press, and Paranoia was just starting back then, and The Excluded Middle, Crash Collusion. It seemed there was a bit of a renaissance during that time with people who were involved in conspiracy theories and UFOs and paranormal and psychedelic and all that kind of happy horse shit. And I dived head first into it, and still going, 14 or 15 years later.
Sweet, sweet. And now, how, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you? Because I couldn't get a gauge on your age from your writing, which I guess
I
might be a compliment. I'm not sure.
45.
Oh, okay.
Born March 12th, 1960, share the same birthday with Albert Einstein and Jack Kerouac.
Oh, nice. Sweet.
And probably some other losers, too.
All right. Well, tell me as much as you want to tell me about the origins of your name, because I was suspicious that that was your real name, and Greg Bishop blew your cover on the intro, on one of the acknowledgments or whatever in your book.
You know, I'm not sure how I came up with that name, but it evolved when I was working on a piece Crash Collusion magazine called UFOs, LSD, and Me, and I really didn't want to put my real name on the piece, so somehow I plucked Adam Gorightly out of the air, and it stuck all these years. I got a name with that name, so I've kind of stuck with it for my writing career.
So it's not like a cover to protect yourself or anything like that, other than for the LSD article?
Well, there's some other reasonings I'd rather not go into, but that's one of the reasons I started using it.
Nice. All right. And then you bill yourself as a crackpot historian, so why don't you tell us a little bit about how you come to that definition and what that means for you.
Something else I seem to pluck out of the air. I've written about a lot of fringe characters. My book on Cary Thornley, he was certainly a fringe character. In this latest book, The Beast of Gorightly, I write about characters like Rock and Rollin' Stewart, who is that psycho you saw back at sporting events back in the 70s and 80s with the Tutti Frutti psychedelic afro. Write about a roller derby star named Psycho Ronnie Raines, and a whole host of characters. So that's why I define myself as a crackpot historian. I'm not necessarily a crackpot, at least not to any great degree, but I've kind of gravitated towards, you know, writing about strange and unusual people.
Nice.
And subject matter.
There you go. And then in the press release I saw, it said you were a 33-degree Freemason. Is that like a joke? Are you really a 33-degree Freemason, and how do you become one?
That's a joke.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask. No,
it isn't.
What's that? Oh,
nothing.
Man.
Actually, I'm a 23rd-degree Discordian.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah. The reason, once again, I was just throwing together a press release, and that kind of had a good ring to it, a crackpot historian and 33rd degree Mason, so.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I was going to ask you if you consider, now also I should have mentioned too, I forgot, but you mentioned it anyway, but your latest book here is The Beast of Adam Gorightly, and that's your collected rantings.
Yes, sir.
From 1992 to 2004, and that's a fantastic book.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, well, I just read it a couple weekends ago, and I really enjoyed it. I flew right through it because it was just an awesome read.
Cool. I'm getting some good feedback on this book. You never know, throwing together a collection of pieces, how marketable it is, because, you know, usually publishers are looking for single themes. So we'll see how this does. I've gotten, once again, good feedback. One person told me it's the ultimate bathroom book. You can, you know.
I can see that, yeah. Now, would you say you take a lighthearted view of the paranormal? Because that seemed to come across in the writings. Would you?
I would say generally I try to, in my writings, try to keep a humorous perspective. At times I go over the top, at other times, you know, I'm pretty serious about the subject matter, but just my writing voice tends to be a bit sardonic as well. So, and that's a problem sometimes. People probably take me less seriously than I probably would like them to, but that's just the way it comes out.
Yeah, you know, you can't, you gotta just put your art out there, right?
And you know, I've written some, I wouldn't say actually hoax articles, but, you know, I've done a few prank articles as well throughout the years. So.
What kind of prank articles?
I'm just thinking one thing I put out there one time had to do with Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan, and how Magic Johnson was actually on the dark side. If you look at Michael Jordan, he wears the magical number 23 on his jersey, and Magic Johnson was 32, and I went into a bunch of things like that, and you can just kind of roll with things like that. And if you're looking for theories hard enough, you can find them. So I've done kind of pieces like that, whimsical things. And then I've gotten pretty heavily into writing about MK Ultra and mind control. I take all of that topic very seriously, because there's evidence out there to show that people have been screwed with over the years by government mind control experimentation.
So let's just roll right into the Beast of Adam Gorightly. Now, it's probably the most generic question you'll ever get, or you get anyway, and it's probably really hard for you to pick one because they're all like your kids, but do you have a favorite piece in the Beast of?
Shoot, let's have a little dead air here for a second. As I open this up. No, I don't. I'm kind of fond of UFOs, LSD, and me, and there's really only a small excerpt in there from that longer article which appeared in Crash Collusion, so that's a favorite. Usually my favorite is the latest thing I'm working on. Probably the latest piece in this is Tuesday Weld is Watching You, about occult secret societies in Santa Cruz, which was a bit of a humorous adventure piece. So I'd say that's my favorite, just because it's probably the last thing I worked on that went into this book.
Nice. So is the book organized, so it's not organized in chronological order?
Pretty much it is chronological, but I put that the Tuesday Weld piece closer up, just once again because I liked it. For the most part, it's pretty much laid out chronologically, yeah, as the pieces were written over the years.
All right, well, why don't you talk a little bit about that Tuesday Weld one, because that's actually one of my favorites and on the list here of ones, and especially I wrote down the Jeff Turner Experience.
Yeah, you should interview Mr. Turner.
I'll consider it. Is he accessible?
Yes. I'm trying to promote him to get out there and do some radio interviews and stuff, and it seems like he's amenable to it. So
after
you're interested, we could talk about that later.
Oh, definitely.
A couple of years back through the Internet, I met a gentleman by the name of Douglas Hawes, and we got to talking. And he was throwing out these theories about this occult secret society based out of Santa Cruz, and how different people had been involved in this society over the years, which basically was an offshoot of the Illuminati. And at one time, he claimed that Tuesday Weld had been a high priest of the Bavarian Illuminati, and basically oversaw the organization during the early to late 60s, and it was basically the person influencing all these rock groups, from the Beatles to the Rolling Stones to the Beach Boys, influencing them towards putting out subliminal messages in their music, promoting this Illuminati agenda, which when I first heard this, I thought it was the most absurd theory I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
But certainly a fascinating one. Just to go on a little bit more with this, sometime in the late 70s, or actually early 70s, a person with the initials KM basically began a feud with Tuesday Weld, and according to Doug Hawes and his informant Jeff Turner, they had this whole satanic or Illuminati feud going on, and the person with the initials KM took over Tuesday Weld's role in this occult secret society, and waged a campaign of terror there in Santa Cruz and on the West Coast for many, many years. So that, in a nutshell, is part of the story there. Jeff Turner, the one who's putting out these allegations and these theories, has I met with him, quite a colorful character, and he's now an adherent of none other than Tiffany, the pop singer, and believes that she is a leader of what he calls the All Nation movements, that Tiffany is involved with Sufis and all these others, and she's basically taken over and put a good spin on all the work of Tuesday Weldon and the lady with the name KM, and is basically trying to bring about a new world order of sorts. So that's the weird, wild, and woolly story of Jeff Turner. One thing that's interesting is, if you look back in newspaper articles from the early 80s, Jeff Turner was arrested for stalking Tiffany.
Yeah, I saw that in the article. I was like, what is going on here?
Right, but nowadays he still has contact with Tiffany, and he claimed that he had actually, through their families, there had been a secret marriage, and that he is Tiffany's secret husband, and that Tiffany still communicates with him, and once again he sees Tiffany as this leader of this All Nations movement, and that she's also a time traveler and all these other strange things. Now, on the surface, you look at this story and you go, wow, this guy's off his rocker.
Yeah.
But I've talked to other people that, you know, you bring up these allegations about Tuesday Weld, and they'll say, yeah, there's something there. Something was going on with her, and also this KM person. There's been other people besides Jeff Turner and Douglas Haas who have heard and seen things going on, and so I haven't directly interviewed some of the folks that Doug Haas says that can confirm this story, but it appears that, you know, there's more than meets the eye of somebody who's off his rocker that's spinning some tales. Now, Jeff Turner might have confabulated a lot of the stories he has told me and Doug Haas, but at the core, there might be something to all this madness.
Yeah, it's pretty. At first, you're kind of laughing, and then as it goes along, you're sort of like, So it's very intriguing.
It would be something to ask people. That's what Douglas Haas says. That for one thing, Jeff Turner's stories have remained consistent over the years, and that when they've asked other people, you know, once again about, is there anything to this Tuesday Weld story? They'll raise their eyes and kind of nod their head to people in Hollywood know about this, but they don't want to talk about it. It's kind of like the relationship between the Manson family and the movie industry and the recording industry back in the 60s. People don't want to talk about it, even though those relationships were going on back then.
So now, you write a lot about the stuff that was going on in the 60s around California. Did you grow up around that area, or is it just a place where you seem to think there's a lot of esoteric breeding ground for, you know, research?
Yes, and yes. I grew up in Central California. Still live here in the Sierra Nevadas. And so, well, yeah, I gravitated with that story about Santa Cruz. I'm only a couple miles from there, so it was easy to take a run over there and talk to some of these folks. Yeah, I'm interested in California history, and I also have a fascination with the 60s counterculture as well, and that comes up quite a bit in my writing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, I'm on a side note here, the poems. You include some poems in the book, which is sort of a nice little sidelight.
Well, thank you. Once again, kind of reticent about putting poetry in collections because I, myself personally, there's not a whole lot of poetry out there these days I'd be interested in anyway. So I it's nice to hear you say that. I'm not sure how really receptive people are to poetry these days.
Oh, I thought it was cool. I mean, they weren't like super long or anything either. You know, if it had been like 6 pages, I would have been like, what's up with this 6-page poem in the middle of the book? But these were.
Yeah, I really cut my teeth initially. Writing verse and lyrics, poetry, worked with rock bands in the mid to late 70s when I was a teenager, and I compose music and lyrics a bit myself these days. So that's kind of where my writing started and evolved in later on, working, trying my hand at fiction and eventually spent most of my time writing nonfiction. But I think I've always had a sense and a knack for writing poetry, I think.
Nice. Okay, now I want to talk to you about the mind control and MK Ultra aspects of your writing and your research, because as you said earlier, you find that to be a pretty serious topic. I think it's a very important topic that some people delve in, a lot of people just don't want to touch it. It's a very important aspect of esoteric research, what do you think?
I would say so, most definitely, just from the aspect of the whole Manchurian candidate conspiracy theories that have been out there for years. When you look at all the different assassinations over and over, you've had these lone nuts who sort of fit the profile of somebody whose mind has been tampered with, specifically somebody like Sirhan Sirhan, who really had no memory of the actual event of the assassination of RFK. And there's, Mark David Chapman fits the same profile. And, I definitely think all those guys I just mentioned have been patsies and MK Ultra subjects. You look at the documentation going back the late 50s, early 60s, there indeed was a government-sponsored mind control project going on that went up by a lot of names, and there was different types of programs going on, with using drugs, LSD, and a lot of people suspect, as well as I do, that LSD was basically flooded into the counterculture as a kind of full-blown mind control experiment. Kesey and all those guys back in the San Francisco in the early 60s basically ended up, the LSD they were first exposed to was stuff CIA was given to all these research facilities. Now, that I've just thrown out a lot of things there. Later in the 70s, when these revelations about MK Ultra surfaced during congressional investigations, at that time the CIA said they discontinued the program back then, but most researchers, myself included, believed it continued on and evolved into beyond drugs to using different types of microwaves and implants and all these other technological things to continue, the whole mind control program.
So you think what those of us who are trying to figure out what it's all about, you think we were only kind of scratching at the surface of what really might, how big this thing might be?
It's interesting. If you do a web search about mind control and the electronic harassment, as they call it, using different types of low-frequency devices and, once again, implants and those types of things. There's different theories about who's involved these days, who's behind all this. There's one lady named Eleanor White who suggests that it's basically vigilantes these days that are involved in a lot of the mind control harassment for whatever reasons.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, I had some incidents, and this is dating back 5 or 6 years ago now, where I felt that I had some type of microwave or some kind of device being beamed at myself, and it happened in two places I would say 6 or 7 times. One was sitting on my couch in my house in the exact same position, and another was in a Mexican restaurant and at the same table there in the same seat. And what happened was my body temperature went up. I'm not sure how much. My face flushed red, and this happened over the period of 4 or 5 minutes. You know, I've had fever before where my body temperature was around 103 or so, and this felt like it was a lot hotter than that. My, you know, I was with my wife on all these occasions, and she saw how my face basically turned a beet red. And then after a few minutes, this stopped. And it's one of those odd things, you know. I'm not 100% sure of anything.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been something I ate, or who knows exactly what went on. But it, you know, it's one of those odd things that have happened to me over the years. I've had undoubtedly my phone tapped, and you know, I've heard this happen talking to certain people, for instance, Greg Bishop on occasion, and other folks. And I was doing the Carrie Thornley book. Robert Anton Wilson was one. Numerous people, you know, some of the same folks. Anytime I talk to them, it's like, oh, what the heck's going on with the phone? I've had my mail tampered with over the years, and so I really don't know anything for sure, I guess I should say, but I suspect a lot of things.
Yeah. Now, when you were having these attacks or fits or whatever you want to call them, was there stuff going on in your life that you think would have caused whatever forces to bring that upon you? Like, were you working on something at the time that was particularly hot?
Well, that was in the period I was working on the Manson book. And, you know, there's material in, once again, the Manson book is The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos, available from finer booksellers. But I got into a lot of the conspiracy theories and talked about, once again, mind control and Manchurian candidates and that type of stuff in the book. One might ask, how's that deal with, you know, how's that relate to the Manson family? And maybe you just need to read the book to find out about all of that. There was a researcher named Mae Brussel who suggested, and she was a famous conspiracy theorist that died in the late 80s, who was heavily involved in Kennedy assassination research and had a radio program for years and years. Anyway, she claimed that the Manson family were basically a military mind control experiment, and that's what first aroused my interest in researching about the Manson family, and I got into all that heavily in the book just to answer my own questions. Was there anything to that? And the book itself then took on a life of its own. I felt if I was going to talk about all the conspiracy theory stuff, I need to put it all in context and basically look at Manson's childhood and the whole history of the Manson family. So over the about 3 years, 3 or 4 years later, when I finished the book, it was nearly 600 pages.
Oh, wow.
And so I really kind of got away from answering your question. I was looking at a lot of the these type of things during the period I was writing the Manson book, so who knows?
Okay, and actually you sort of segued right into the Manson question. Let me get back to the mind control thing because I forgot about one more thing. You sort of tie that in a little bit to the UFO phenomenon, so
yeah.
We may as well talk about that. How do you tie the mind control into the UFO thing? How do you think that they may be related, obviously?
One fascinating book, and it's actually never was published. You can still probably find it on the Internet. Samizdat document called The Controllers by Martin Cannon. Did you ever see that?
No.
That surfaced in the late 80s and just blew my mind when I read it. His theory was basically that a lot of the, or all of the abduction, UFO abduction phenomena was basically a cover for mind control. Military mind control.
Okay.
They just used that to mask, to cover up what they were doing, you know, and they basically plant these memories in their heads that they were actually alien greys or whatever involved in the abductions and planting the implants and all that type of stuff. So that kind of how it figures in. I was, you know, when I read that book finally, it made a lot of sense to me. Once again, I don't subscribe 100% to any one theory.
Yeah.
So that's one of the ways that I think UFOs tie into mind control or altered states of consciousness. I think altered states of consciousness are directly intertwined with the whole UFO phenomenon.
Yeah, because like as you said, in your book you have an excerpt of UFOs, LSD, and me, and that's about your own UFO experience.
Right.
And what was that like? Because I've never seen a UFO. I've talked to people that have, obviously. I've never heard anyone like downplay it. It seems like a life changing experience. So what?
Yeah. Well, it definitely was. I'll recount the incident for you as concisely as I can. It happened in the late 70s in a central California burg, highly populated city, and a friend of myself and I dropped some acid. Several other people did, and we were kind of hanging out, and the vibes got a little bit heavy, so we decided to take off, go for a walk along a levee in town, and even before we hit the levee, we were joking around, you know. What if we saw a UFO, you know? Nobody'd believe us, you know. We'd be telling the edit, you know, it'd be ridiculous. And sure enough, not long afterwards, we started seeing a whole host of UFOs. The first one I saw affected me so much that I fell to one knee.
Oh, wow.
And we were seeing the same sights and sounds, but it was something like out of, the UFOs themselves were cartoonish looking. You had some of the classical UFOs. I mean, they're all different shapes and sizes. You had cigar-shaped UFOs, but then you had other ones with multicolored propellers and all this strange, probably, I don't remember the exact number, but six or seven of these we saw over the course, walking along the levee, you know, over the course of 45 minutes or so.
Oh, wow.
Right before, after we saw the last one, we were walking back, retracing our steps, beam of light came out of the sky.
Oh, man.
And it was, once again, I'm not sure on the distance, 50, 100 feet away, emanating from nothing we could see. And that basically ended the experience. That's it in a nutshell, but you know, the odd thing about, okay, sure, you're on LSD, you're seeing all this stuff, but both my friend and I saw the same exact thing. So if they were hallucinations, they were dual hallucinations.
Yeah, I don't know if that's rare. That seems like it would be pretty unlikely.
Now, a theory that made a lot of sense to me, kind of explaining this stuff, John Keel talked about in one of his books. I don't remember exactly which one, but he got into talking about psychedelics and altered states. And what he felt was when you tap into these other realms through psychedelics or whatever means, it's like you're seeing into another dimension, or you're seeing in infrared.
Oh, man, yeah.
For instance. Yeah. And so that's possibly what could have happened to us. We, you know, the drug, whatever, triggered this altered state where we could see into another dimension that is possibly all around us all the time, you know, but we normally can't access it.
Yeah, that speaks to the what I've been hearing a lot about lately, too, is the ayahuasca and the DMT type research that's going on.
And, yeah.
That sounds pretty similar to what they're saying coming out of that research.
And Terrence McKenna talked about psychedelics and UFOs and their relationship in a lot of his books. What's interesting about DMT, and I've never done DMT, but the experience, it seems to be repeatable through a large group of people. They go to the same relative place and see a lot of the same thing, and there's kind of a playful nature to the experience, which I equate to my UFO experience. The UFOs seem more like playful entities. And you get into talking about this stuff, and it puts a whole different spin on, you know, talking about UFOs as opposed to nuts and bolt crafts and, you know, serious conversations about, you know, can they actually, you know, solid objects with grazed from Zeta Reticuli to, you know, is this all a part of the human experience? They're maybe not necessarily from outer space. They inhabit some of the same realms we do. We just can't always access them.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's definitely part of the UFO phenomenon. And I think maybe it gets downplayed because of the association with the drug use. Not you in particular, but in general. You know,
well, sure, and you can discount everything I said. You know, it's easy to write that off, but until you've, you know, somebody has actually experimented with different mind-expanding chemicals, can they appreciate the weight of those experiences, you know? Once again, you know, they've had a profound impact on my life. And that's not to say I haven't done any psychedelics in a long, long time, but, you know, they still have that impact upon me, and they changed my life.
Yeah. Now, sort of throwing back here to the 60s counterculture and the Manson family, what sort of drove you to do, because I'm a huge Manson fan. I couldn't believe I'm going to have to get this book. I was psyched when I saw that, and I loved the excerpt in The Beast Of.
Yeah, well, I first got interested in Manson, I guess it was in the mid-70s, 76 or so. The Helter Skelter movie, made-for-TV movie came on, and I remember getting together with a bunch of friends, and we got a bunch of beer and just watched this, and it was a crack-up, actually. I mean, pretty horrid story and tell, but the guy who played the part of Manson in that was Steve Railsback. He just did a wonderful job, and anyway, I got interested, started reading the books over the years, and you know, it just seemed like a mind blowing pill. Then later on, as I was telling you before, I heard these conspiracy theories about the Manson family. So it was one of those things. Previously, I'd got involved in reading about the Kennedy assassination, so I got kind of obsessed with that for a number of years, and same thing kind of happened when I looked into the Manson family. There's just tons of books and all kinds of things out there talking about it, so it's sorting through all that and trying to make some sense out of it and put my own spin on the thing.
Now, what did you what kind of conclusions did you come to from your research into the Manson family? Obviously, you didn't push one particular theory or anything, but what sort of in your mind, what was going on with that whole story?
Well, I think it, it's closely related to, once again, we're talking about Manson's role with the music industry in Hollywood, and I think he was basically pissed off about not getting a recording contract, and that's one of the things that led to the murders. Bear in mind that Sharon Tate and the folks murdered at the Polanski residence that night. That had previously, actually was still owned at the time by Doris Day's son, Terry Melcher, who is a big music producer in L.A. during that period, produced the Birds and the Monkees, and had been talking to Manson about doing an album, and Manson had cut various sessions with, for instance, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys was a big supporter of Manson, so they had cut some demo recordings and had this going on, and basically, Melcher got kind of wigged out by Manson. He got to know him better and stepped out of the picture. And I think Manson probably knew that Melcher wasn't living in the house anymore, but was leaving a message with those murders. And I think also drugs were heavily involved, not only the Mansonoids being brainwashed to a certain extent by drugs, but drug dealing, drug burns, and these type of things. One of the victims at the Polanski residence was named Wojtek Frykowski. He was a friend of Polanski, and he was a big dealer in different drugs during that period. And it appears that the Manson family were embroiled in all of this, and so there might have been multiple reasons. Once again, drug deals that went sour, and Manson being pissed off by the whole music industry that they had screwed him over.
Yeah, and it sounded like from the excerpt that I read that Manson, that it's sort of like Hollywood's and the music industry's dirty little secret that Manson was sort of running around in those circles back in those days.
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly.
And so what, like, how prominent was Manson with some of these celebrities and music types? Like, were they knew him before all this went down, right?
Well, Manson, for a period of time, lived at Dennis Wilson's house, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. That was one connection. Dennis Wilson was really taken in with Manson. Manson recorded at Brian Wilson's house / recording studio. Neil Young thought very highly of Manson, thought he was a great poet, songwriter. I think Manson gave Neil Young a motorcycle, if I remember exactly. There was rumors that the Manson family were like at parties, for instance, with members of the Mamas and Papas, John Phillips, that the Manson family spent a lot of time with Cass Elliot. And so you hear all these different things. He was very involved in the Topanga Canyon scene at that time, where everybody gravitated to during that period.
Yeah, he was trying to sort of make it in the music industry. But do you think he was just destined to flake out?
probably so. and such he did. So yeah, he must have been destined to